an act relating to adjustments to oil and gas production tax values based on a percentage of gross value at the point of production.
Lawmakers gavel into the special session with reforming oil taxes at the top of their agenda. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, April 18th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the court system works to fill several judge vacancies in Bethel.
It's particularly hard to fill positions in Bethel, in part because of the high cost of living.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life. Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them, and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted, so make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
The U.S. Attorney's Office in Anchorage today announced three new charges against Israel Keyes for allegedly kidnapping and killing 18-year-old Samantha Koenig. Kevin Feldes, chief of the criminal division of the Anchorage U.S. Attorney's Office, described the charges in a press conference this afternoon.
The indictment alleges that Israel Keyes abducted Samantha Koenig from the Common Grounds coffee stand on Tudor Road on February 1st, 2012. And that he took her against her will to his white pickup truck that was parked across the street. The allegations continue that he confined her and intentionally killed her early the next morning.
Investigators say they tracked ATM withdrawals by Keyes through several states before arresting and returning him to Alaska. Koenig's body was found under the ice of Matanuska Lake in early April. The crime of kidnapping and killing Koenig carries a maximum penalty of life in prison or death. Keyes is set to be arraigned in federal court on the charges tomorrow. The special legislative session got underway this afternoon with a streamlined agenda. Lawmakers are considering three subjects: an in-state gas line from the North Slope to South Central, a bill strengthening the state's sex crimes law, and a bill rewriting the state's oil tax regime. Joining us from Juneau is APRN's Dave Donaldson. Hi, Dave.
Hello there.
Let's talk about what's in play here. The sex trafficking bill was expected to pass quickly. Is there a problem?
No, none at all. The Senate just didn't get around to it. That big blast of dozens of bills, and somehow this one got stuck down at the bottom. It's fine. They came up on the floor today. They made an amendment to it. What the problem, and the only real problem, is nothing to do with the bill whatsoever. The Senate doesn't have enough votes, people physically present, to vote on the bill. Once that comes into play, it'll be on the schedule again tomorrow. They'll vote it over to the House. The House will agree to this real simple little amendment. What the amendment does is it makes it so that not only is interstate sex trafficking illegal, this is the one little amendment that actually makes it illegal to bring somebody from one city to another in Alaska. Any movement whatsoever. After all the talk that's been done on this thing, I was just totally shocked that that was not in there, but it wasn't. So this will take care of that. House will go for it easily, and this will be done by the end of the day tomorrow, probably.
Dave, the in-state gas line has been tied up in the House and Senate for two sessions. Will that be that easy to work on?
It's not going to be as quick as the sex crimes bill. It took it 14 months just to get through the House, and the Senate's had one hearing on it so far. They're going into it again tomorrow morning with another hearing. There'll be no problem with getting it heard, but there's an awful lot of controversy here.
The governor did introduce a new oil tax bill, though. What's the change from his previous bill?
It's including some of the things that the Senate had put in its bill. He's selling it as a combination bill. House and Senate have passed various different versions of the thing. For example, it gives a major discount for developing new oil fields, and is another discount, totally separate way of calculating it for producers who want to enlarge the existing fields. There are limits on the progressivity or the increasing tax rate as oil prices go up. I have not seen anybody who has actually got a economist or a fiscal analysis of this thing. And it's just simply too early for anybody to make any statements whatsoever on it. They want to see what it actually means. This will come out for a first hearing on Friday, but I don't have any ideas to how it's going to be received because we got to have those numbers first.
Today was the first day of the special session, so where do we go from here?
I'm getting a feeling it's going to be for a while. The House Resources Committee alone has scheduled about 10 days worth of hearings on this oil tax bill. That in itself is just going to take an awful lot of time. And they haven't guaranteed that they will finish after 10 days. It's just that that's what they've scheduled so far. Consider that there are at least four committees that are going to deal with it. And I think that there's the trend has been on these oil tax things to repeat the same stuff over and over again until everybody seems to have had their say. And it's going to take them a long time to get through with this thing.
All right, Dave. Well, thanks for the first day update.
Okay.
APRN's Dave Donaldson reporting from Juneau. The Anchorage Assembly heard emotional public testimony at their regular meeting last night. Representatives of the Anchorage chapters of the NAACP and the ACLU, as well as 17 voters, called on the body to appoint an independent investigator to look into possible voter disenfranchisement during the April 3rd municipal election. But as KSKA's Daisha Eaton reports, the Assembly went about business as usual instead.
With a shadow still hanging over the municipal election, the Anchorage Assembly decided to stick to their agenda, appointing a new chair and vice chair. The body voted Ernie Hall in as chair, replacing Debbie Osiander, and Jennifer Johnston replaced Hall as vice chair. Chair Hall said the Assembly's hands are tied because they're waiting on a report from the Election Commission.
We would love to have had that report come to us tonight, but we think it is much more important that we give them the time to do their job right.
The commission completed the election canvass Tuesday, which sets the number of question and absentee ballots to be counted at 13,435. It's been 2 weeks now since polling places ran out of ballots, forcing some voters to run from precinct to precinct trying to vote. Some report being turned away at the polls until they close, but nobody knows exactly how many voters were unable to vote. Jeffrey Mittman, the executive director of the ACLU of Alaska, says the longer the assembly waits, the more difficult an investigation will be.
The longer we delay, the more memory fades, the less records are available, the less documents are available. We should have begun this process already. There was really no reason not to have moved forward tonight.
The commission's report is expected to be presented to the assembly at their next regular meeting on April 24th. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Anchorage celebrates Keegan Randall's World Cup victory.
18 weeks, putting my head down weekend after weekend, performing in any condition you could think of. It's been a big journey.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers loans tailored for first-time homebuyers, plus home choice education seminars that can help determine if a mortgage would be less than rent. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
It's rare to hear good news when it comes to the endangered species list, but today, federal scientists announced one species common to Alaska deserves to be taken off the list. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez has more.
While Steller sea lions in the western part of the state are seeing their population dwindle, those in eastern Alaska are experiencing a boom. In the past 15 years, the number of eastern Steller sea lions has doubled up to 70,000 animals, and now federal biologists want to take the animal off the endangered species list. Nearly 2,000 species have been placed on that list since it was created. If the eastern Steller sea lion is removed from it, it will be only the second animal to have achieved recovery status. The sea lion population was nearly wiped out in the early half of the 20th century by people who believed the animals were competing with commercial fishermen for food. The practice of shooting the sea lions was banned in the 1970s, and the population started to rebound shortly thereafter. Conservationists are happy with the news. John Warrenchuk is a scientist with Oceana.
I mean, this is a conservation success story. You know, as when we stopped shooting them indiscriminately and ended things like bounties and predator control programs, they recovered.
But while the eastern stock of Steller sea lions may be in good shape, the western stock is still threatened. Dana Seegers works in the Protected Resources Division of the National Marine Fisheries Service, and he says that the eastern population's recovery can't easily be replicated. It was clear that the eastern population was declining because the sea lions were being shot, but there's no definitive agreement on what's causing the western stock to shrink. Nutritional stress, competition with commercial fisheries, and whale predation have all been listed as potential reasons for their decline. Seegers adds that it's not enough to just be satisfied with the recovery of the eastern Steller sea lion, since the two stocks are so different.
The genetics of the two really are quite dissimilar and do show very distinct individual characteristics in the DNA. So, you know, you couldn't look at them and tell them apart, but genetically you can.
NIMS now has 1 year to decide whether to remove the eastern Steller sea lion from the endangered species list. If it is delisted, the stock will still be regulated and monitored under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. In Unalaska, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
The Bethel Courthouse serves more than 50 communities in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Now it is struggling with judge vacancies, with three of its four judgeships soon to be empty. KYUK's Angela Denning Barnes reports.
The Bethel Court usually has a magistrate and three judges, two for the Superior Court and one district court judge. Soon, though, the magistrate will be the only filled position. The current situation comes from retirements and the fact that the positions are just hard to fill.
I know that it's a big problem.
Larry Cohn is the executive director for the Alaska Judicial Council, the group tasked with the hiring process.
Bethel has a big caseload. In addition to the district court and the two Superior Court vacancies, my understanding is that there's turnover in the magistrate position as well.
A new magistrate, Bruce Ward, has just been hired. He'll start the job May 1st, but the other three positions will remain vacant for now. Superior Court Judge Leonard Devaney and District Court Judge Dennis Cummings have both announced their retirements. Cummings is retiring this month. However, he is restricted from working anyway after the Alaska Commission on Judicial Conduct found him guilty of misconduct. They've recommended that he be removed from the bench. The other Superior Court judgeship has been vacant for a year since Judge Marvin Hamilton's unexpected death in April 2011. Cohn says the Judicial Council has been in the process of trying to fill Hamilton's position, but they didn't have the required two qualified applicants to send to the governor during the first application cycle.
And so we re-advertised the position.
It's particularly hard to fill positions in Bethel and some other rural areas, in part because of the high cost of living.
Ron Woods is the area court administrator for the 4th Judicial District. He says judges in urban areas generally have higher salaries than those in rural Alaska.
To some extent, the compensation differential is not in line with what it needs to be to make the positions more attractive.
Six applicants have applied for the Bethel Superior Court and just two for the District Court. The Alaska Judicial Council will meet in Bethel May 8th and 9th to interview them. The Judicial Council must send at least two qualified applicants for each position to the governor, who then has 45 days to make the appointments. Wood says the 4th Judicial District will continue to fill Bethel's vacancies with temporary judges who stay in a combination of leased apartment units and hotels while in Bethel.
The good news is that there are resources that will be available to ensure the continuation of the case flow and to ensure that the citizens of the community have court services.
Wood says the hiring process takes about 8 months running smoothly. They hope to have positions for the Superior Court and District Court filled by late summer. The other Superior Court position will likely be filled early next year. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
GCI announced this week it intends to roll out faster internet plans in 65 communities in the YK Delta and Bristol Bay. The faster internet speeds would be realized by switching from satellite-based internet connections to terrestrial lines. KYUK's Mark Earhart has the story.
Internet in the villages can be pretty slow.
Everybody's complaining. Even at my house, I have my own, and the wireless doesn't work too good. You know, it's really disappointing.
That's Stanley Tom of Newtok. He's the tribal administrator for the Newtok Traditional Council. He not only uses GCI internet at home, but he uses it at work as well.
When we have usage for like two or three people online, it's really slow. It takes forever.
David Morris, GCI spokesperson, says there may be hope for frustrated village users. The company announced a plan to deploy terrestrial broadband in Newtok and other communities across the YK Delta.
Construction will start the 1st of June, and we expect to be complete by mid-October.
The new plan would utilize GCI's Terra Southwest system, a ground network said to be faster than the old system that used satellites. Morris says the new lines will be connected to hubs within each village.
We take the internet signals at each one of the community locations, and we then put that on an antenna that we then send the signals throughout the village location via Wi-Fi.
He says GCI will offer several new plans ranging from $30 to well over $100 a month. Tom says he currently pays about $50 a month for the fastest plan available in Newtok. With one of the proposed faster internet plans, he could quadruple the old plan speed and still pay just about the same per month. But that is still slow compared to GCI service available in Anchorage, where a similar priced plan will get you 10 times the speed. Tom says people in the village would be receptive to faster internet, but would not want to pay for the proposed Cadillac service plans that cost $115 and $170 a month, respectively.
If it's too high, I don't think people will want to hook up to that amount. It's just too high.
Morris says putting in the new connections to the villages may not be an exact science, though.
We've never connected all of Southwest Alaska to the terrestrial connection, so we are a little bit cautious.
He says it is likely there will be some snags with the new system within the villages, as Wi-Fi can easily be disrupted by buildings and trees. Tom says he thinks it's worth it to bring faster internet to communities throughout the region, as long as it doesn't break the bank.
I hope they take the word to upgrade and let the villages pay less amount, like $30.
In Bethel, I'm Mark Earhart.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. The Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991. On the web at akbudgetreport.com. Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
They say history is written by the winners. That's certainly the case with a new book by Howard Weaver, the former managing editor of the Anchorage Daily News. Write Hard, Die Free, dispatches from the battlefields and barrooms of the Great Alaska Newspaper War, tells of a time when the city of Anchorage was one of the last of its size to have two newspapers in competition. The Daily News won, APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
The Anchorage Daily News had none of the prestige of the city's afternoon paper, the Anchorage Times. But Howard Weaver says in the early 1970s, that underdog position was a perfect fit for a working-class kid from Muldoon with big ambitions.
It was definitely number two in terms of money and circulation and prestige and influence. But it had, as a result, this kind of quest feeling. At the Daily News, we had the opportunity to do that in ways that, frankly, the Anchorage Times didn't. I mean, they were a very establishment newspaper. Not surprising. They were the establishment. But there were certain constraints, I think, on them that we didn't feel, and that opened up the field to us to do a lot of things, and we had some real fun doing it.
The newspaper business in those early years was a lot more colorful than it later became, and Weaver describes that atmosphere with relish. He did a lot of police reporting, and then the pipeline boom hit Alaska, and there was plenty to write about. The paper nearly went broke, though, and rather than get laid off, Weaver quit and joined forces with other reporters, forming a paper of their own, The Advocate. It never made money, but it was colorful, and it suited the outrageous times the paper wrote about. By the time it went broke 2 years later, Daily News publisher Kay Fanning had sold her paper to the McClatchy chain in Sacramento. And that's where the money came from to go up against the Times. On the way, the Daily News won two Pulitzer Prizes for public service, most recently in 1988 for the series People in Peril, which documented the ravages of alcoholism and suicide in Alaska Native villages. It was one of many risks the paper took.
I was very aware going into this that we were in an urban, largely white newspaper writing about the problems of rural, largely brown people. And that is just loaded. And both suicide and alcoholism are issues that are surrounded by denial, right? Nobody talks about their cousin's suicide. Nobody talks about their mom's alcoholism. But the fact is, we became convinced that it was such a huge problem and that if people didn't talk about it, there was no hope to fix it. Now, obviously, it's extremely difficult to fix, and our stories did not fix it. I wish I could even say with any confidence that they started the fix, but I do know that they made it legitimate to talk about it.
In writing his story for Epicenter Press, Weaver discovered he had to write about his own alcohol problem as well. It was needed, he says, to explain why the later part of the book was so different from the earlier part.
I mean, I needed to tell people drinking had been such a big part of my early career that it just wasn't honest to not mention that a big change came right in the middle, sort of 1985. I think about that sometimes. And, you know, as an adult, I guess I've now been sober longer than I was not sober.
But the bad old days of the Anchorage Daily News had their Pulitzer, too. That one came for a series on Teamsters Local 959, which grew amazingly wealthy and powerful during the pipeline era. The stories by Weaver and Bob Porterfield were viewed as an exposé of abuses, but Weaver says they also documented a time of unprecedented ascendancy in the history of organized labor nationwide.
We spent a lot of time talking about some of the abuses and some of the problems politically and otherwise that they had created, but the fact is, during that window of opportunity of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline construction, it was an extraordinary institution.
There was a time when the Teamsters even had their own hospital, but they couldn't hold on to their wealth after the boom and ended up going bankrupt. The newspaper business, too, hit hard times with the advent of the Internet. Weaver ended up helping McClatchy to pilot its way into a web presence, but the chain also took on a lot of debt in acquiring other papers, and the results were waves of employee buyouts, especially in Alaska. Now there is far less overall reporting by all news media, and nobody knows what the future of journalism is. But Howard Weaver is one of those who remains upbeat.
The fact is that people with a passion for things will find a way to exercise that passion, and it won't always be the same. Tomorrow's journalism will not be the same. Certainly the delivery systems won't be the same. But I fully expect that it will evolve and mature into a valuable contribution, and that the young people sitting out there today, you know, who are 21, 2, 3 years old, are going to be the ones that figure that out. I got a chance to do it. I sat there, I played this incredible long shot, and it paid off into a 40-year career that you know, I got to do a lot of stuff. I made some money. I made an enormous number of friends, and I had fun.
Weaver says he might write another book, tracing the roots of the rise of a different sort of spirit in the state than what he grew up with. He's not the first person to observe that everything changed with the pipeline boom, but he was certainly in a good position to watch how it happened. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
World champion cross-country skier Keegan Randall got a hero's welcome in her hometown yesterday. Anchorage fans lined up for the champ's autographs at a celebration of her achievements, hosted by enthusiastic winter sports fans. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer was there.
Keegan Randall's fans, most of them on skis despite mushy snow, welcomed the world champion with cheers and cowbells. The Alaska Pacific University cross-country ski team paraded into Kincaid Park in front of Randall, who arrived atop a huge trail grooming machine. Randall took to the podium, waving her Josca Crystal Globe trophy.
Wow, wow, wow. About a few weeks ago, when I was receiving the Crystal Globe from the King of Sweden and got to feel that crystal in my hand for the first time, I thought that was a pretty magical moment. Little did I know that a month later, I would be parading into the Kincaid Stadium and getting a chance to share this globe and this accomplishment with all of you. And I have to say, man, you guys blow the Swedish king out of the water.
Randall told the crowd about her journey to the Crystal Globe from her junior Nordic ski days through high school championships and the disappointment of finishing 61st in her first Olympics.
And still believing deep down that someday I could be the best in the world.
Then rising to finish 36 grueling World Cup races in Europe.
18 weeks, putting my head down weekend after weekend, performing in any condition you could think of, to get all the way to the end and accept this on the top of the podium. It's been a big journey.
Randall credited her teams, APU and the U.S. Olympic ski team, with helping her heighten her performance. Randall is the first American to win the title in 30 years and has topped that by being the first American woman to ever win a world championship in cross-country skiing. But she showed the crowd she's still a hometown girl, saying that she believes in the power of possibility and that she may be the first Alaskan to bring home the trophy, but won't be the only one.
The door has been open, you guys.
At 16, Randall decided to focus on cross-country skiing, and she encouraged young skiers to follow their dreams, advice not lost on little Marley Snyder, who says she's on familiar ground with the champion.
I went to Keegan Randall's wedding.
6-year-old Marley may have a head start on ski competitions.
On Sunday, I went down to the biggest hill at Kincaid.
Who knows where she'll finish? I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Angela Denning Barnes and Mark Earhart in Bethel. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.